Hi everybody, this is Bill Ward of Black Sabbath. You're listening to the Mark After Dark show.
Mad, Mark After Dark, the man that hates everything except the real thing, coming to you once again, live on the air. Tonight on the program, legendary drummer of Black Sabbath, Bill Ward.
You started playing the drums at age 7. By 11 years old, you started getting more serious about playing. You grew up listening to jazz drummers like Gene Krupa and Louis Belson. Was there any particular piece of music they might have played on that inspired you to play?
Sing Sing. That's what pulled me in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Glenn Miller's String of Pearls and Moonlight Serenade and Basie, I can't think of one Basie song right now, but I liked a lot of the things that came
Yeah,
out
I can hear it
too.
In your style. I've always been able to hear a lot of jazz influence in the way you play, so it's just kind of interesting to me about that you incorporated that into Sabbath and, in, you know, so. Anyway, Tony and you were childhood friends and also schoolmates. The both of you played in a band together called The Rest, which later became Mythology. What did this band sound like, and how would you compare it to Black Sabbath?
Well, can I just put one thing straight for the record?
Mm-hmm.
I think I actually started playing drums when I was about 3 or 4.
Oh, really?
Then I got more serious when I was 7.
I'm sorry.
And by the time I was 11, I think I was playing gigs, so...
Wow.
In fact, I was playing weddings and things like that.
Yeah.
Also, it was Tony that went to school with Ozzy.
Oh.
I didn't meet Tony Iommi until I was about 15 and a half, 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, and our band at the time, we were doing pretty much what everybody else was doing.
So like blues.
And, you know, we wanted to play gigs, and in order to play gigs, you had to play certain things. Certain standards, if you like, so Johnny B. Goode and Chuck Berry songs, you know, some of the contemporary songs of whatever that time was. So that time, let me just see if I can date that. That would be 1563.
That's all right.
So by 64, whatever might have been popular in America in 1964, that's what we
mm-hmm.
were playing. You know, so. You know, just rock and roll, Carl Perkins, you know.
Oh, great stuff.
Things like that. But when we turned about 17 years old, that's when we really, really started to listen to the British blues bands. And there was a tremendous, in the mid-60s, there was a tremendous, surge of
oh yeah, you had John Mayall's Blues Breakers.
Yeah, the Blues Breakers, Keith Hartley, John Heisman, Exple Smith. All these guys were playing jazz and blues, and that was where we moved. That's kind of where we were pulled towards. It was like a magnet.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so we left kind of the poppy and the old traditional rock and roll, and moved more into the jazz blues feel.
Yeah,
and that's what we were into when we were 18 years old, when Ozzy and Geezer, you know, it kind of, you know, when we finally become Earth.
Yeah,
you know,
and you had a horn section, from what I've read.
In the beginning, just for one gig actually, and for a lot of rehearsals before that.
Yeah, what was that sound like?
It was cool, you know, because it was just like this kind of jazz blues feel, and then you had these horn solos and slide guitar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was pretty good, but take away the horn and take away the slide guitar, and you have, you know, four other people that were going, you know, that were going a little bit further than
mm-hmm.
their kind of at that time they were in a blues parameter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only we were only just around the corner from moving into our own particular styles of music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the Mythology was basically going back to Mythology. I know you mentioned that band.
Yeah,
they were basically a blues kind of pop band. You know, we throw a couple of, there was a band called Art at the time.
Yeah.
And Spooky Tooth.
Oh, Spooky Tooth are great.
And so we would play a couple of their, you know, their songs. We knew Spooky Tooth, the guys in Spooky Tooth, pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them come from Carlisle in Northern England. So
you know, it's funny that you mention that, because I interviewed Simon Kirk like last year, and you probably know Simon.
Yeah.
And he mentioned the Spooky Tooth too, knowing them and hanging out,
yeah,
and playing with them and stuff. So it's just funny.
So they were, you know. They were like a spawning ground, because they went on into other bands as well.
Mm-hmm.
Into, you know, but they were very accessible guys. You know, Mick Kelly, the drummer, was from Birmingham, and I'd known Mick for off and on for years, since I was like 14 years old. So they were just very available, like I said. And you know, we would spoof a couple of their songs and. You know, so those were the influences that were kind of where mythology was coming from. And we do all the standard blues things as well. Elmore James songs, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Mississippi, Delta music, you know, so.
It's great stuff. Okay, well, in the 1996 book, Wheels of Confusion, The Story of Black Sabbath, written by Stephen Rosen.
Yes.
You mentioned a dream that the four of you had at the same time. Can you give me some, I mean, in the book you didn't really, can you give me some more details on the dream, and was the fifth member part of it?
Well, the fifth member, or what I always call the fifth member, it's an invisible
entity
or force.
Mm-hmm.
So the dreams that we were having, we all had dreams over a period of a few weeks about a monk, and but nobody shared this dream with each other. In other words, you know, nobody, we didn't bother to say that to anybody until we were actually all in a van heading for somewhere, and you know, we were on tour somewhere, and we started talking about the dreams, you know, and every single person confessed that they'd had a dream about a monk, you know, or some entity, you know, like either a religious entity or something that was or a spiritual entity, you know, or something like that. We'd all had exactly the same dreams. And it was really the time when we all, it was, you know, put a shiver up my spine, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, I was like the third one, I think, to fess up to my dream, you know, about just seeing a monk appear in my life. You know, he was in a dream, and there was a very strong association with him. And I didn't know it was because we're all going to be religious leaders later on in life or something, you know. I didn't know if it was my vicar calling, you know, to make light of it for a second. But it was one of the things that I think is important to say is that we lived together, we did everything together, we played together, we ate together, we went to the bathroom together, we slept together, you know, we even slept in the same bed together. You know, so the band couldn't have been any tighter, I don't think.
Yeah.
When you've got four guys just with that incredible amount of energy that's starting to build and build and build, and it's about to burst open, it doesn't surprise me that we would have similar
dreams
or similar, you know, it's just strange sometimes how things can be passed through each other, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And but yeah, it was a surprise for all of us that we'd all had a dream or dreams, continuous dreams, about seeing a monk. And you know, I was pretty amazed by that. You know, it's true to say as well. Again, and I don't know how much of this is because we lived together and we did everything together. But when we played, when we were jamming. You know, some of the early stuff just came literally as if it was being played by, you know, some other force.
Yeah, I read that in that book.
You know, and it led me to believe that we were just more or less like conduits, you know,
mm-hmm.
To this energy, because I was just amazed sometimes that we'd just sit down and we'd have three quarters of a song or a whole song done. You know, like it was already lying there waiting to be picked up, you know. So I'm sure, you know, I mean, that was just how it appeared for me. I know that we put a lot of hard work into it as well.
You know, oh, yeah.
Especially, you know, Tony coming up with the riffs in the first place, you know, so together, so. But yeah, that's kind of what that was about.
In an April 15th, 1971 review of Paranoid, which appeared in Rolling Stone magazine, the critics bashed Sabbath for being eternally foiled by their stupidity. Besides calling Black Sabbath's music bubblegum Satanism, the reviewer ironically commits an error of his own when he confesses Ozzy with Kip Winger, the lead singer of Black Widow, who claimed he sounds like Keith Ralph whining about the tampon stuck up his nostrils. Were you flattered or offended by bands like Black Widow, Bang, and Pentagram for trying to copy Sabbath's style?
No, not at all. To be honest with you, I was so selfish and self-centered, I didn't really notice that anything else was going on around me. And that's the truth of the matter. I mean, I knew about Black Widow and, you know, there was a lot of bands, actually.
Yeah, I mean, there was so many. There still are.
To me, every single day was taken up with either practicing or trying playing new music or playing a gig. So we were constantly on the road. And the biggest priority of the day back then was to make sure that we could get something to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure that we could get plenty of sleep so that we can play our gigs, you know. It was about the gig, it was about playing in front of people. So the focus was really there. I wasn't aware of stepping outside of the touring parameters or the, you know, the gigs that we were doing. Like I said, in some ways it was very selfish, and, you know. But I wasn't that aware, especially in the first 3 years of our touring, which would, you know, from an English point of view, that would be 69,
mm-hmm.
70 and 71, where we were just absolutely non-stop. I mean, we were just absolutely balls to the wall, up until we did Masters of Reality, and the tour that we did behind Masters of Reality, we were pretty exhausted by that point, you know, but so I don't really have a definitive thing to say, a definitive response, you know, to your question, because I felt so absorbed with the things that were going on constantly with Black Sabbath, you know.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Well, in a Circus magazine article, Black Sabbath: The Sound and the Fury, dated March 1971, Black Sabbath were playing a show with Cactus, held at the Sunshine Inn in Asbury Park, New Jersey, which nearly erupted into a backstage riot after a young Cactus roadie was beaten up by Tony Iommi and then manager Patrick Meehan for accusing the members of Sabbath for stealing a towel containing Cactus supplies. Rumor had it that the members of Cactus were assembling 100 men to jump Sabbath while playing on stage. Supposedly, they were getting a gun and also spiked Sabbath's water glasses with turpentine. Do you recall any of these?
I recall that there was a skirmish between us and Cactus, yeah. And I was on the outer parts of that skirmish, you know. Something had happened. I think it could be best described as a clash of egos, you know, more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
There was a drummer playing in that band that I respected a great deal, still do. But Carmine was there, and, you know, I just didn't want to, you know, I just shined it on, you know. I don't know, there were fights, there's no question about it. Backstage, there was always some kind of problem, some kind of fight. But I think that what had happened that was what was in the towel. I think was just some dope. I think we got accused of ripping off their dope, you know. And at the time, we had plenty of our own dope, you know. So you know, it just went down bad. I think that the word threats that were made, and I think it came from various people that were working for Cactus. But I'm not sure if that was the same time that we had that somebody put a gun in the audience, because that did happen. And I'm not sure if they put 100 guys out there either. I would find that very unrealistic, actually, that a band that's on the road would find 100 guys and put them out in the audience, you know.
Yeah, well, that was just a rumor. And when I read that, I was like, damn.
Yeah. No, I'm sure there was a skirmish. You know, I don't know, I'm sure Tony would be able to, you know, really bring light to that one. I'm not at all sure. But I can remember there were, you know, things would rub the wrong way sometimes backstage. You know, between bands, that's something that was quite commonplace, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
In December 71 Circus magazine, you say that the group made an effort to put a strong peace message on its latest album, Masters of Reality. However, you also make a statement that Satan could be God, since no God but Satan have created such a world. Do you regret this statement because it further links Sabbath to Satan?
Did I say that?
Yes.
I still believe that. Okay. No, I don't regret the statement at all. You know, at the time in my world, as far as I'm concerned, and a lot of times now, even though my life has completely changed in so many different ways now, you know, I wonder who's running the show here when I see shit going down, and I see, you know, so many what I consider to be pretty much idiotic people, in very powerful positions, bringing just a bunch of shit-ass trouble to people, to men, women, and children who just want to get on with their lives, but they're content to watch TV, raise families, play sports, you know, have fun, and go to school, and you know, work their asses off for a living. I mean, just regular people, you know, and you know, shit happens, and. I've always had some controversy inside me.
Yeah, so do I.
So why really shit things have to happen to people?
The New Orleans thing I think was terrible.
Well, New Orleans is absolutely fucking horrible. 9/11 was horrible. World War II was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
What happened? The Holocaust was fucking terrible. I mean, it's been numerous. Nam was terrible. I mean, just everything, you know. And it's like. Sometimes I just, you know, I wonder who's running the show. I really do. I don't know whether, you know, I don't know whether it's God or Satan. When I was a kid, I think I was about 7 or 8 years old, and I can remember making a statement about making a comparison between Adolf Hitler and Jesus Christ.
Well, that must have made people real happy.
And my father said, leave the room before I kill you. I didn't make that statement again, but you know, I was making a comparison in the sense of popularity, or in the sense of devotion, you know, or in the sense of hate, you know, what binded people together, you know, and I think about that sometimes, Mark, and I think, my God, I thought that when I was 7 or 8 years old.
Wow.
You know, and it's like, wow, you know, that blows me away that I had that kind of an intellect at 7 or 8 years old. And I'm not trying to be big-headed or anything here, you know. These days I find I know very little about anything, but which is a pretty good place to be in now. Why not? You know, I don't know who's running this place. I don't know who the lord of this world is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think that these days, I don't regret the statement, which was, I guess, was your question, these days, I try to have a God consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a religious man. I still haven't gotten along too well with religion, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
But I do try to have a God consciousness or a spiritual consciousness that allows me to see a lot of the beauty on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
But it also allows me to see a lot of the stuff that's I get to see the beauty, but you know, you get to see all the other stuff too, really, really clearly, and that's quite painful.
Okay. Okay, well, in a review of Volume 4 from January 73 issue of Cream magazine, the album is described as presenting two examples of Black Sabbath's Sound of Tomorrow, Changes and Laguna Sunrise. While these songs didn't exactly prove to be the future direction for the band, they still represented a significant departure in style for the band. At the time, did you approve of doing something a bit different? Did you think the fan would be receptive to it?
As far as the fans are concerned, I never knew if our music was going to be accepted.
Mm-hmm.
I was so nervous and so fearful that every time we put out a record, no matter what it was, I never knew if it would be accepted. So I guess that might answer that question right there. That's just me, you know, that's just the way I am, you know. Which is kind of a pretty terrifying way to live your life, you know, because it's almost like, oh God, you know, is this going to be acceptable or not, you know. But primarily, obviously we'd make an album that was acceptable for us first, you know. And that's how I've always kind of looked at our albums, you know. It's like, wow, does this sound good? Do I like this? Yeah. You know, do I like participating in this? Yeah. You know, so you know, obviously the albums were acceptable for me, as I'm sure they were for everybody else. And I, after we did our third album, Masters of Reality, we were real veterans. We'd done so much touring across the world, back and forth, and we hadn't stopped. So I think that I think songs like Changes were very apropos. I think they were exactly where we were. And Laguna Sunrise, I thought, was a great interpretation of a place where Tony had never been, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Ozzy, myself, and Geezer, we used to visit Laguna, and we used to hang out there, you know, with the hippies, and we used to hang out there with all the heads.
Yeah.
And we used to get high for a few days and just hang, you know. And we used to just take psilocybin and sit on the beach, you know. It was great. And what happened was that we would always come back into LA, back to the hotel. And then I think that Tony was able to see in us Laguna, and he wrote Laguna Sunrise. And I think that's just absolutely incredible that he put that together. So I like the way that came about. And it's stuff that was going on. We would get some time off, and we wanted to get high and, you know, spend time with what were then, you know, righteous people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what was going on at that time. And we would go down to Laguna, and it was quiet, you know.
Okay.
Kind of not like it is now. Laguna's pretty noisy these days, but back then it was a little bit quieter. Not quite as busy.
Okay.
So I think that Volume 4 was very reflective.
During the recording of Volume 4 on Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, keyboardist Rick Wakeman was involved in the process. Did this have any impact on the chemistry of the four of you, and what was it like having him in the studio?
I think it was a lot of fun. You know, I thought it was fun having Rick there, and I don't think it really screwed with the chemistry. You know, we knew Rick. We toured with Yes a lot, you know. So, you know, and Rick spent a lot of time with us on the road. So it was just like our friend. We, you know, Rick was our friend, and still is to this day.
Yeah, he's a great musician.
No.
You did most of the rehearsals for Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath in a dungeon of a big castle. The members of the band claimed to have seen a ghost. Did you ever figure out who the ghost was?
No, never found out. But we certainly had some chilling moments back in that place.
I'd love to hear, you know, some stories.
It was a lot of fun, you know. But you know, Tony and Ozzy are real practical jokers, you know.
Well, they all three of them.
Yeah, well, Ozzy. You know, I don't want to discount Geezer in this. I don't let him off the hook so easy. And so they played a lot of pranks and came up with some really good ideas on how to scare the living shit out of me by using fishing wire, which you can't see at night.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so they were so elaborate with their plans. It's a wonder we got an album done, you know. Just there was so much time and energy spent on setting up these booby traps and a picture would fall off the mantelpiece, you know, and things like that, you know, in the middle of the night. And they were up, you know. I laugh my balls off when I think about them being up at 2 a.m. in the morning, you know, kind of going through this elaborate thing and pulling on fishing wire, you know, that's like two floors below in order to knock over knock over a picture on the mantelpiece so it would scare me, you know. I mean, I'm honored. I'm fucking honored, you know. They're beautiful. They really are.
Yeah.
Great guys.
And that was part one of my interview with legendary drummer Bill Ward. Stay tuned. There's more to come.